Much of popular music today is dominated by women. From Ariana Grande to Megan Thee Stallion to Doja Cat and Dua Lipa, whenever you turn on the radio these days, you're bound to find one female pop star or another. But was this always the way that the music business functioned? The simple answer is no. Up until the turn of the century, women weren't often considered to be on the same level as the testosterone-fueled rock titans such as Aerosmith or, unfortunately, even Motley Crue. Yes, there were many female performers to achieve moderate or even icon-level success, but they were often viewed as a subgenre to that of the boys. This is much due to the fact that, up until the early 2000s, when Britney Spears sent the world into a bubblegum pop frenzy, the music scene was mainly dominated by rock-based acts. You see, it was often a misconception among rock fans and musicians alike that the rock and roll lifestyle wasn't fit for women. This was, of course, BS, as being a musician has nothing to do with consuming unquantifiable amounts of cocaine or sleeping with every girl possible, although I bet Nikki Sixx might disagree with you. My point is, many people, during the height of rock and roll and all of its subgenres, believed that women couldn't rock. This episode, I intend to prove them wrong. Good afternoon, Golden Hawks, and thank you for tuning in to Radio Laurier. My name is Megan, and you are listening to The Downbeat, a show where I get into the nitty-gritty, the deep cuts, and the hot topics of rock and roll throughout the decades. This week, we are talking women in rock, figures of importance who paved the way for female-identifying musicians of today. I'll be focusing on multiple women who made their mark on the industry, stuck it to the man, and discuss any notable setbacks that they faced out of sexism. To start it all off, we have to first pay tribute to the Queen of Soul. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Born the daughter of a pastor in Memphis, Tennessee, Aretha Franklin grew up on hearing some of the best gospel singers in the world. At the age of 18, she moved out to New York to pursue her dream of becoming a recording artist. She was signed to Columbia Records in 1960, but after a few failed singles with the company, she was out of a contract in 1966. It wasn't until Franklin recorded a cover of Otis Redding's Respect that she had her first hit. The irony is, the song is actually pretty sexist if you take a look at the original lyrics. From the perspective of a working man, Redding sings of giving his woman any material possessions that she wants, as long as she shows him some respect when he gets home. Aretha flipped this message on its head, turning the tune into a feminist anthem. Her version went number one on the Billboard Hot 100, and Redding's didn't even crack the top 30. In 1987, Aretha became the first female performer to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Rolling Stone magazine has named her the 9th greatest artist of all time. Twice. An inspiration to women, particularly black women everywhere, Aretha Franklin was the first star status female rock star to make her mark on the industry. Now, if you've been living under a rock and have never heard the Queen of Soul before, I would say that Chain of Fools, Think, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, and I Say a Little Prayer are all good places to start. Now, aside from Aretha, other notable female artists of the 60s that had sort of a soul feel include the Ronettes, the Supremes, and Ella Fitzgerald. All of these acts are solar funk singers, but let's not forget, rock and roll has its roots in soul and the blues. Rock would be nothing without the black women who helped found it. Also during the 60s, while some were grooving to Aretha, others were taking a liking to the folk sensibilities of Bob Dylan and other free spirits. The folk revival of the 1960s was heavily focused on a sense of unity among performers and their audiences. True folkniks often gathered to support a common cause, and oftentimes this was the civil rights movement. The sense of oneness was also solidified in their performance style. Unlike the showboat pop style of many popular acts of the time, whom folkniks saw as capitalist sellouts, folk singers wanted to feel as if they were one of the audience members. The only difference between them and the other faces in the crowd was that they were sharing their gift of song with the rest of them. Now, this isn't to say that the folk revival wasn't without its stars. As of today, when most people think about folk in the 60s, they think about Bob Dylan, with his acoustic in hand and harmonica in his mouth. But possibly the second most well-known figure of the era was Staten Island native Joan Baez.
Well, I'll be damned, here comes your ghost again, but that's not unusual.
Baez thrived in, and arguably helped to build, the counterculture era of the 1960s. The content of her songs usually centered around themes of social justice and protest. She herself is a songwriter, but most often her most successful recordings were covers of other well-known acts, including the Allman Brothers Band, Woody Guthrie, and others. Just taking a look at her Spotify, you'll see her second most streamed song on the platform is a cover of the Animals classic, House of the Rising Sun. Have a listen.
I had listened to my mama.
Although it may seem that Baez is of lesser importance to folk music, given that the majority of her success came from covers, however, it was by recording these covers that she helped to launch Bob Dylan's entire career. At the time, Baez was already an established and celebrated artist. When she met Dylan and listened to some of his songs, she recorded her own versions, helping to share his art with a larger audience and aiding in his rise to fame. Without Baez, perhaps Dylan never would have had the means to have such a large impact on the music that he did. But we're not here to talk about Bob Dylan, we're here to discuss women in rock. So, who else from this folk era are we forgetting? Well, you can't mention the acoustic-based folk era without mentioning Canadian-born songstress with the voice of an angel, Miss Joni Mitchell. If you've ever watched the documentary Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, you'll catch up on quite a bit of folk rock history in one go. The film follows Dylan on his tour of America with many other notable folk acts featured in this review. Featured in the film is, of course, Bob Dylan, as well as Joan Baez. But in a quick moment behind the scenes of the show, we also catch a glimpse of Joni Mitchell. I remember watching the film when it came out in 2019 and enjoying it quite a bit, but the largest thing I took away from this 2-hour and 22-minute film about Bob Dylan was, I need to listen to more Joni Mitchell.
Rose and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air.
I think that the career of Joni Mitchell can best be summed up in this quote from the Ringer journalist Lindsay Zolitz. Over a singular career that has spanned many different cultural eras, she explored in public, to an almost unprecedented degree, exactly what it means to be female and free, in full acknowledgement of all its injustice and joy. At the very beginning of her career, Joni was not a solo act, but in fact a duo with her then husband, Chuck Mitchell. She was only 23 at the time, while Chuck was much older and more educated, and he never let her forget that. But one thing that Joni was far better at Chuck then was whipping up odd new chords on her guitar. From what I've gathered, it seems as though Joni was far more talented than Chuck in a musical sense. Chuck recognized this and so set to work trying to ensure Joni knew her place. He would give her book recommendations he thought that she wouldn't be able to read or fully comprehend, just to prove his intellectual dominance. But when they got on stage, none of that mattered. It was clear that Joni was the true genius. One day, he told her to read the novel Henderson, The Rain King by Saul Bellow. Again, this wasn't a genuine gesture, thinking that his wife would enjoy the book and thus giving it a mention over her morning coffee. It was a pompous way of making her feel lesser than. Joni detested this, so this time she actually picked up a copy of the book before catching a flight. The irony is that the narrator of the book was also describing being on a plane. A direct quote from the book reads, "We are the first generation to see clouds from both sides." Are you seeing where I'm going with this? That day, Joni Mitchell, on a plane looking down on the world, contemplating the meaning of life, wrote her infamous song, Both Sides Now. Soon after this day, while Chuck and Joni were doing their usual gig at the Gaslight Club in New York, in walked none other than Joan Baez. Joan would later say that as soon as she heard them, she recognized Joni's immense talent and thought to herself that Joni should ditch her husband, and not long after, she did. From this realization, this breaking free from the domestic life she was not well suited for, Joni made some of the best, most well-written music of modern musical history. Her 1971 album, Blue, was voted the number one album written by a woman, which in itself is a bit of a backhanded compliment, but an achievement nonetheless. What's ironic about this consolation prize of an award is that the album itself is firmly rooted in a strictly female perspective. Most men would flee from the idea of enjoying such a collection of music, but Rolling Stone magazine, of all places, gave it their highest regards. Critic Ann Powers wrote, "Blue remains the clearest and most animated musical map to the new world that women traced, sometimes invisibly within their daily lives in the aftermath of the utopian, dream-crushing 1960s. So, in this scenario, the conclusion can be drawn that there is space in discourse surrounding rock and roll-based music for women of true talent, but it must be a subsection to the otherwise macho musings of the Hendrixes and Plants of the world." Mitchell has spoken on this, saying that she felt as though she was always regarded as not a folk singer, but a female folk singer, an other that was often lumped in with Joan Baez and other singers of the time, but never the geniuses. Joan Baez is an immense talent, there's no questioning that, but Joni writes and performs her own music entirely. Her lyrics border poetry, and her songwriting is unmatched. Bob Dylan was considered a genius, but why not Joni Mitchell? And the fact that this other category for women still exists today, taking the fact this list from the Rolling Stone of the top however many albums made by women was published in 2017, and this is why I felt it was necessary to record an episode on this topic. Not to again separate the women from the boys, but rather to highlight their unmatched contributions, where they are so often overlooked. Oh, and by the way, in the magazine's list for the 500 greatest albums of all time, Blue only placed 30th.
All the California, California, coming home. I'm gonna see the folks I dig.
Now, stepping away from folk for a second, let's talk a little bit about some important women in psychedelia. The Woodstock Festival of 1969 would have been far less worth the horrid sleeping and sanitary conditions if it weren't for killer performances by Janis Joplin and Grace Slick of Jefferson Airplane. Jefferson Airplane, one of the key groups of the psychedelic rock era, is best known for their 1967 release, Surrealistic Pillow, which includes hits White Rabbit and Somebody to Love. Without singer Grace Slick, however, the band likely wouldn't have been met with the same success that they did, and here's why. In 1965, Slick was contemplating a career in music. She was also a painter and wasn't convinced that music was something that she wanted to pursue. It wasn't until that she saw Jefferson Airplane live, then with a different lead vocalist, that she decided to form a band of her own. The Great Society, which was her band, consisted of Grace herself, her husband Jerry Slick, his brother Darby Slick, and bassist David Miner. Well, with the group, Grace wrote both of the hits I mentioned above. She later decided to abandon the Great Society to join Jefferson Airplane a few years later when the band's singer left to have a baby, and she took the two hits with her. The one that I want to discuss is White Rabbit. When logic and proportion have fallen slowly dead, and the white knight. Possibly one of the most well-known and essential tracks of the psychedelic era, White Rabbit is the quintessential psychedelic rock song. It is written in a way that reflects the feeling of hallucinogenic drugs, and as such, is likely intended to be listened to while under the influence of psychedelics. Now, I'm not recommending this, of course. I'm just saying that there is a reason not many people had an issue with the treacherous conditions of the Woodstock Festival site, if you catch my drift. For psychedelia fans, music was a fully immersive experience, and this type of music would have been far less impactful if it were not for the brilliant writing of Grace Slick. Now, one last thing that I want to point out about Grace's contributions to the genre is the quality of her writing. I'm not going to lie to you, I have never listened to a Grateful Dead song and enjoyed it enough to add it to my library. I know, if you're a fan, I am so very sorry, but it's true. Maybe I'm just ignorant and haven't done my due diligence in fully exploring their discography, but what I think separates Slick from the pack is that the enjoyability of her songs is not reliant on psychedelic drugs. You can enjoy White Rabbit or Somebody to Love just as much sober as you could after dropping acid. I don't think I could say the same for the majority of Grateful Dead songs. For these reasons, I knew I needed to give her a mention in this week's episode. Another kick-ass woman in the psychedelic scene was none other than hard-rocking mezzo-soprano Miss Janis Joplin. Janis Joplin is a great example of how other musical genres, specifically black originated genres, are the basis of rock and roll. One of the most important figures in psychedelic rock, Joplin's vocal style is largely influenced by female soul singers of the past, mainly the queen herself, Miss Aretha Franklin. Janis Joplin's growling powerhouse of a voice mesmerized audiences in her time, performing with Big Brother and the Holding Company. Her signature stage performance style, which was eccentric, to say the least, was a favorite among psychedelia fans. During her time with Big Brother, Janis produced hits such as Peace of My Heart and Summertime. A few years later, she released a solo album titled Pearl, which included well-known songs Me and Bobby McGee and Cry Baby. Although her career was short-lived, she died of a heroin overdose at the age of 27 in 1970. During her time in the spotlight, Janis made a major impact on the psychedelic scene, being a crowd favorite at both the Monterey Pop Festival in 67 and Woodstock in 69. In 2001, she ranked 46 in Rolling Stone's 100 Greatest Artists of All Time.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train on us feeling near Spain.
Moving away from the hippie musings of San Francisco, we now turn our attention to the East Coast, where many notable women were making their mark on the indie rock scene, which would eventually progress into the punk scene of New York City. One of them was featured on what many now consider to be the first true indie album, The Velvet Underground and Nico. Who was it? Well, I just told you. Nico, born Krista Pafkin, was a German singer, songwriter, musician, model, and actress. During her teen years living in Berlin, Nico worked as a seamstress. At the age of 13, she quit school and started selling lingerie at a local department store. While working at the store, she was scouted to become a model, and through that career, she became quite successful while still in her teen years. She was given the stage name Nico by the modeling scout who discovered her, and she kept it ever since. Thanks to her modeling career, Nico ended up in New York City, where she met many of the music industry's biggest names at the time, including Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, and yes, I am mentioning him again, Bob Dylan. It was through these individuals that she met Andy Warhol and began working with him on some of his more experimental films. At the time, Warhol was managing a band by the name of the Velvet Underground. It was by his suggestion that the group took on Nico. They felt as though the group was well-balanced as it was, but Warhol thought that they could use a female voice. Reluctantly, the group agreed, and what resulted was one of the best early indie albums ever made. Funnily enough, at the time, it wasn't that well received. It was, however, featured as the majority of the musical material for Warhol's multimedia performance, Exploding Plastic Inevitable, which included multiple live events from 1966 to 1967 in New York City. After these shows, Nico separated from the underground and began a solo career, although much of her work is nothing to write home about, let's just say. Nonetheless, we appreciate her contributions to the roots of punk rock and the club scene from which it flourished. Another favorite of early NYC punks was poet-turned-songwriter Patti Smith.
Love is a banquet on which we feed.
Patti was exposed to musical and artistic influences. Her mother was a jazz singer and provided her with plenty of inspiration, including records by Harry Belafonte, Patience and Prudence, and Bob Dylan. In 1967, at the age of 21, she moved to New York City, where she met Robert Mapplethorpe. The two fell in love, but had a turbulent relationship due to battling poverty on and off and Mapplethorpe struggling with his own sexuality. Nonetheless, the two were each extremely artistic, and their romance had a major influence on each other's work. Not necessarily in the inspiring love song sense, but in a two sets of critical eyes are better than one kind of way. They encouraged and inspired each other to produce the best work that they could, Patti as a poet and Robert as a photographer. Many of Patti's album covers are in fact portraits taken by Robert himself. But I'm getting sidetracked here. Back to the music. After a move to Paris with her sister, where she made money busking and through performance art, Patti made her way back to New York City in 1969, where she lived in the infamous Chelsea Hotel with Robert, who was then her husband. It wasn't until the 70s that Patti made her biggest contributions to the music scene, at the height of the punk movement. She was one of the first acts to popularize the New York club CBGB, which is now famous as basically the birthplace of punk. At the time, she was a poet, playwright, and occasional writer for Rolling Stone and Cream magazines. Her performances were at first poetry readings backed by guitar, but progressed to include singing as well. In 1974, she released a single called Hey Joe on an independent label, which many considered to be the very first true punk single. In the same year, she became the first of the CBGB group, which had grown to include the likes of the Ramones and Blondie, to be signed to a major record label. She put out the album Horses in 1975, which includes the song Gloria and this iconic line.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
It was a bold statement, to say the least, and people fell in love with her for it. To this day, Patti is regarded for her outspokenness, and many attribute the birth and spread of punk rock to her in many regards, so thank you, Patti. Another group that I mentioned who played at CBGB was none other than Debbie Harry fronted Blondie. For those who are unfamiliar, no, Blondie is not a person, but actually a band. The band is, however, named after the lead singer Deborah Debbie Harry and her iconic bleach blonde hairstyle with dyed black underlayers. Blondie is probably the most commercially successful group to come out of the New York punk scene. They started with a more true punk sound, with simple guitar-based instrumentation accompanied by a few keyboards. Throughout their time in the spotlight, they progressed to new wave, which was essentially punk watered down to appeal to more narrow-minded audiences. After all, the older American public at the time had taken an issue with lyrics such as that of Patti Smith, and to sell on the major labels, you needed people to like you. This isn't to say that Blondie's later releases weren't good, they were actually one of the first groups that I ever really got into. So let's put that knowledge to the test and talk a little bit more about Debbie herself. Debbie Harry was born in Florida in 1945 and put up for adoption by her mother. She was later adopted by a couple living in New Jersey, where she grew up. Debbie later shared in a memoir that she had always fantasized that her birth mother was actually Marilyn Monroe, which, based strictly on looks, I guess isn't that far-fetched. Before her music career, Debbie worked as a dancer, a Playboy bunny, and waitress after graduating from college. In 1974, she formed Blondie in New York City, and it didn't take long for a girl with her face, style, and super cool hair to become a punk icon. As a part of Blondie, Debbie put out 5 hit albums within the span of 4 years. Among these included the monster hit album Parallel Lines, which included singles One Way or Another and Heart of Glass. After her success with Blondie in the 70s, Debbie went on to try her hand at acting and a solo career. Throughout the years, the group has split up and gotten back together on several occasions, but none of their newer releases have garnered the same success as that of the 70s. Overall, Debbie Harry is likely the most iconic figure to emerge from the heyday of punk rock, and for that reason, she will always be an idol of mine and the first name that comes to mind when I think of women in rock. Now, if we're talking about women who defied stereotypes to be true rock and rollers, we have to give mention to the first all-girl rock band, The Runaways. Consisting of Joan Jett, Cherie Curry, Lita Ford, Sandy West, and Jackie Fox, the 5 girls were brought together by producer Kim Fowley. The group found fame in 1979 after being signed to Mercury Records. Their debut album was released shortly afterwards, and they toured for a while as openers for bands such as Cheap Trick and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. An interesting approach, each of the members based their stage personas after that of their rock idols. Curry imitated David Bowie, Jett mimicked Suzy Quatro, Ford chose Jeff Beck, West tried her hand at Roger Taylor, and Fox, Gene Simmons. The group put out a total of 4 albums before disbanding in 1979. During their time in the spotlight, they rubbed elbows with much of the punk groups from CBGB, such as Generation X, then fronted by Billy Idol. They also had a very successful tour stint in Japan and made waves worldwide with hits such as Cherry Bomb. The group did not last long, but provided us with one of rock's most recognizable female faces, Joan Jett. I saw him dancing there by the record machine. I knew he must have been about 17. After her time with the Runaways, Jett went on to have a very successful solo career and formed another band called Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. During her time with the group, Jett put out many songs now considered to be rock and roll classics. These included I Love Rock and Roll, Bad Reputation, Crimson and Clover, and I Hate Myself for Loving You. It is undeniable that Jett concocted the ultimate female rocker look, which is now iconic. Her intense eyeliner and spiky black hair screamed, "Don't mess with me," and it made her all the more recognizable. Today, we appreciate Joan Jett for not only her musical contributions, but for her paving the way for women in rock who are less conventionally feminine. She proved that girls can rock just as hard as the boys and could look tough doing it. Now, I know you're all waiting for this one. How could we even begin to discuss women in rock without mentioning the White Witch herself, Stevie Nicks? Now here you go again, you say you want your freedom. Well, who am I to keep you down? In California, during her senior year of high school, Stephanie Stevie Nicks met some guy by the name of Lindsey Buckingham. Imagine that. At the time, Lindsey was in a psychedelic rock group called Fritz, but 2 of the members were leaving for college. As a result, he asked Stevie to join the group. She agreed, and the group ended up opening for Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin from 1968 to 1970. Not a bad gig for seniors in high school. She attributed much of her stage performance vigor to observing these 2 masters at work for 2 years on tour. In 1972, Fritz disbanded, and Nicks and Buckingham, already a couple at this point, worked as a duo for a while. Buckingham joined another group for a while as a guitarist, and Stevie wrote during this time. And she whipped up a couple of songs by the names of Rhiannon and Landslide. You may have heard of them. In 1974, a demo of the pair's duo album was played for drummer Mick Fleetwood, who at the time had his own band. Can you guess the name of it? He invited Lindsey to join as a guitarist, but Lindsey insisted that Stevie come along with him, and Mick thought that this was a great idea. Thus, Fleetwood Mac was born. During her time with the group, Stevie's song Rhiannon became a hit from their first album, which was self-titled. Landslide was also featured on the album and also became a hit. It was clear that Stevie and her songwriting, as well as incredible vocal performance ability, was a strong asset for the group. After the release of their first album, Nicks broke up with Buckingham, making for some fantastic songwriting material for their second release, Rumors. Her contribution to the album, Dreams, was their only number one hit single. The album itself was a major, major success, being the highest-selling album of 1977. After a few more releases with the band, Nicks embarked on a solo career that was also quite fruitful. Of this came possibly one of her most famous songs, Edge of 17, released in 1981. Nicks is now one of the most iconic figures in rock history, with her performance style, fashion moments, and of course, incredible songwriting ability becoming the definition of iconic. Any little girl who dreams of becoming a rock star likely worships at the altar of Stevie Nicks. Happens, not oftentimes, but sometimes, when an international act becomes far more popular in Canada than it does in its country of origin. It happened with the Monks and their album Bad Habits in 1979, and it happened again in that exact same year with American singer-songwriter Pat Benatar. Her 1979 album, In the Heat of the Night, was a huge success here in Canada, reaching number 3 on the album charts. I can guarantee you, my mother and her friends helped contribute to this. If you don't believe me, I have her original copy on vinyl to prove it. Benatar, much like Joan Jett, was one of the first women to reach rock and roll status and obtain a true rocker image as a solo act. Unlike the women I've discussed previously who were all part of kind of precursor genres to flat-out rock and roll or were making rock and roll history and didn't quite know it, Pat Benatar thrived on being known as the rocker chick. Her most well-known single, Heartbreaker, is the definition of I'm a woman who rocks. It has everything you could ever need. Screaming vocals, a killer build-up, and one hell of a guitar solo. Have a listen. Alongside Heartbreaker, Benatar had a series of other hits, many of which swayed more towards pop rock than true rock. These included Hit Me With Your Best Shot and Love Is a Battlefield. If you're looking for a true 80s sound, look no further than these singles. Among the women on this list, Benatar may not have been the most influential for other women who would rise to fame, but she's a perfect example of what the trailblazing of women before her allowed for women in the industry to do. To become hard-rocking chicks who sing about sex and other promiscuities that were, and get this, extremely commercially successful. How about that? Taking it back to the underground, we have to start talking about what the early days of the grunge movement looked like. And who better to start with than Sonic Youth frontwoman Kim Gordon. After a great deal of time spent in university, Kim Gordon left California for the East Coast in 1980. She wanted to pursue a career in the arts and held many various positions in the field, from writing to exhibition curation. At the same time, while living in New York City, Kim stumbled upon the newest music scene building there called No Wave. She said she took a liking to it because it wasn't just destroying rock like punk was, it was really destroying rock. She enjoyed it so much that, regardless of the fact that she couldn't play an instrument and was 27 years old, she decided to form a band of her own. Originally a trio, Sonic Youth debuted their first album in 1981. They had a few releases under their belts before signing to a major label in 1990 and releasing Goo, their first commercial success. Now, to many alternative-minded people, this was blasphemy. Many stuck their nose up at major labels for their controlling nature and money-hungry, capitalistic attitudes. And Sonic Youth had become a symbol of the anti-establishment. For this reason, the album didn't get as much attention from underground audiences as it should have. To promote Goo, Sonic Youth even went on tour with other major grunge bands at the time, including Nirvana and Mudhoney. It was through this tour that Kim met Hole singer Courtney Love, as she often toured with them, being married to Nirvana frontman Kurt Cobain. Courtney asked him to produce her band's first debut record, Pretty on the Inside, which she agreed to and has since become a cult favorite among many grunge fans. Aside from music and music production, Kim also tried her hand at a business venture. X-Girl was a clothing line that Gordon co-founded in 1993 with a storefront in LA that opened in 1994. That same year, she gave birth to her daughter, Coco Haley Gordon Moore. After the birth of Coco, Gordon took on various other art-based projects beyond her music. She even helped direct a music video for fellow grunge band L7. Finding this out, in addition to the fact that she produced Hole's debut album, really made me respect Kim Gordon all the more. Not only was she an incredibly talented artist in her own right, I mean, at 27 she couldn't even play guitar and then she became one of the crown jewels of the New York City indie rock scene, but she also helped to see other talented women succeed in the industry as well. And that's why she's getting a dedication in this episode. Also, just a side note, Cool Thing by Sonic Youth is one of my favorite songs of all time. You need to hear it. So, as I said, Kim Gordon and Sonic Youth are often regarded as the predecessors to some of grunge's biggest names. Among them was the all-female bill, L7. For the majority of their success, L7 consisted of Susie Gardner, Danita Sparks, Jennifer Finch, and Dee Plakis. I hope I said that right. But in the beginning, it was just Sparks and Gardner who formed the group. The pair met through the art punk scene that was building in LA and started playing shows together with various other backing musicians. After a couple of attempts at finding a steady drummer, eventually the other members of the usual lineup came on board, and they signed with Sub Pop Records. Sub Pop was considered one of the best indie labels at the time, and with them, L7 released Smell the Magic in 1990, which is considered by some to be one of Sub Pop's best releases. Now, if you've listened to the first episode of this podcast and are trying to figure out where you know Sub Pop from, it is the same label on which Nirvana released their very first album, Bleach. The headquarters is based in Seattle. In 1991, L7 helped to develop the idea of Rock for Choice. Rock for Choice was a pro-choice women's rights group that hosted a kind of Live Aid-inspired concert series to raise money to cover legal expenses due to the prolonged anti-abortion violence and women's clinic bombings of the 80s and 90s. The lineup for the concert included L7, Nirvana, Hole, and Sister Double Happiness. Attendees got a kit to help them throw their own events in their own towns to promote Rock for Choice, and apparently 37 of such events have actually happened across the US, so that's pretty cool. At one event hosted by the band, each member came out on stage in mock pageant outfits. Each had a sash reading a city where anti-abortion violence had occurred. The movement continued into 2001, but the group slowly distanced itself from these events, focusing on their next musical release. In 1992, they released their most commercially and critically successful album. The album was Bricks Are Heavy and was produced by Butch Vig. The record contained their best-known song to date, Pretend That We're Dead. The song spent 13 weeks on the U.S. Alternative Songs chart. Overall, L7 was the first all-female rock band to bring gender-based violence and taboo topics such as abortion into the public spotlight. And honestly, I don't know anything that's more punk rock than that. Now, if you're listening to this and you know me, you know what's coming next. We're talking women. We're talking rock. We're talking 90s grunge. Let's talk Hole. Founded by Courtney Love and guitarist Eric Erlandson in LA in 1989, Hole was a grunge rock band particularly popular amongst supporters of the Riot Grrrl movement. The usual lineup during the height of their success consisted of Love and Erlandson, as well as drummer Patty Schmel and bassist Kristen Pfaff, and Melissa Oftemar was also a bassist. Their first album, Pretty on the Inside, remember the one that Kim Gordon produced, was released in 1991 and was met with much critical acclaim. Their second album, which by the way is my favorite album of all time, was called Live Through This and released by DCG Records in 1994. The record was a massive success, gaining platinum status and making Hole one of the most successful rock bands of all time that was fronted by a woman.
The sky was made of amethyst, and all the stars were just like little fish.
Despite the massive success of Live Through This, Love couldn't really enjoy the success of the album as much, as the release of the record was around the same time that her husband, Kurt Cobain, was struggling with his mental health. Listeners of the first episode will recall that Kurt took his own life in April of the same year. After some time off, Hole returned in 1998 with their most commercial and clean-sounding album, Celebrity Skin. Live Through This was a step in the less punk direction for the group in comparison to Pretty on the Inside, but Celebrity Skin marked a much greater leap into the pop direction. Nonetheless, the album still has many great tracks, including possibly their best-known song, Celebrity Skin, as well as Awful and Malibu. Celebrity Skin was the last release with the band's core members as they disbanded in 2002. Some of the members came back together in 2010, Courtney included, to produce Pretty on the Inside. Now, I know many people discount this record, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I listened to the album as a whole. Whole, that wasn't intentional. But the two songs from it that I have in my library, I thoroughly enjoy. They are the title track, as well as the track called Skinny Little Bitch. I'm telling you, if you're a Hole fan and won't give this record a chance, you just have to. Overall, the band is extremely influential in terms of the ability for a female-fronted, indie-rooted group to meet such critical and commercial acclaim. If you never listen to them, I beg of you, please do. Finally, we can't go without mentioning the pioneers of the Riot Grrrl movement of the 90s. Kathleen Hanna fronted Bikini Kill. Hailing from Washington, Bikini Kill is one of the harshest bands to make this list. Their lyricism was essential for the Riot Grrrl movement that they founded, much of them radically feminist in theme. Accompanied by aggressive performances and thrashing guitar, Bikini Kill's music was a battle call of sorts for women across the U.S. During their first tours, Kathleen also published a fanzine, which is like an amateur magazine made for fans, that was also named Bikini Kill. The group encouraged women to attend the concerts and ushered them to the front of the stage to grab lyric sheets so that they could sing along. Band members would personally jump into the crowd to remove any unwanted male hecklers. These men would often verbally and physically abuse Hanna during shows, proving that their message was getting out there and, likely to their delight, was getting under the skin of sexists. The band released several EPs, with their most recognizable songs including Rebel Girl and Carnival. Bikini Kill were likely the most outspokenly feminist group in rock history for their time. If you think about it, if it weren't for a hardcore-influenced punk band from the 90s, women in music today wouldn't have been able to sing about their sexual desires on the radio, which has since become the lyrical norm. So, think Bikini Kill the next time you sing the majority of modern pop radio. I won't go too in-depth with the rest of the grunge movement, but to say that grunge is solely Nirvana, Alice in Chains, and Soundgarden would be a crime. Bikini Kill, L7, Hole, Veruca Salt, and others all contributed to some of the decade's best music as well. Other rock-influenced women of the time included Hope Sandoval of Mazzie Star, Fiona Apple, and Gwen Stefani of No Doubt. Getting into the 2000s, we got rock-rooted acts such as Alanis Morissette, The Cranberries, and yes, even Avril Lavigne. After the late 90s, the line between rock stars and pop stars had blurred, with the majority of popular music becoming the furthest from true guitar rock as it has possibly ever been. However, it is the influences and contributions made by these women in rock that paved the way for women in the industry today. And for that, we owe them a whole lot more credit than they often get.
Well, I went to school. Oh. Well, I went to school. Well, I went to school.
Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of The Downbeat. As always, if you have any suggestions for the show, feel free to send them my way over on Instagram. Especially if there's anything that I, like, briefly mentioned during an episode that you want to know a little bit more about. Let a girl know, and we can do some sort of deep dive into that topic. But that being said, thanks again for listening, and hopefully, I'll see you next week. Bye.